Hi, this is Jason Berggren, formerly of Strongarm, and this is my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I have to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Being realistic.
As the story grows.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and I have Jason Berggren, formerly of Strongarm, on the other end of the phone. How you doing, Mr. Jason?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. My pleasure. I'm excited to talk to you because I just spoke to Chris, your former drummer from the first album, and then became the vocalist for the second album. And I have some Strongarm things going on, laying under the surface.
That's fine. And, if you want to hear the other side, the side.
Nah, man. I'm not the dirt digger guy, but I did want to talk to you because I would love to hear your side of it. And I'm not doing this as a way of comparison to put you up against them or anything like that. But I just got to thinking in speaking to him, there was a book written, and I thought, and I even said on his episode, like, hey man, I wouldn't talk to somebody else about Jason's book. I would talk to him about it. It wouldn't be fair for, like, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I thought, well, yeah, why the hell am I not talking to Jason? I should just call him because I love that album too. So,
well, his episode was great. I listened to it and I thought he did a great job.
I did too. It got a lot of warm responses because there's a lot of big Strongarm fans out there. So I'm stoked to hear your story.
Well, I appreciate that. I honor that. You know, I still get emails and messages, believe it or not, about Strongarm, which is always surprising because, I mean, I know Strongarm had a big influence on people. I don't get them as much as I used to because, hey, we're all getting a little older here. But I do still get them, and I really appreciate it. It's always a huge honor and blessing.
How'd you get started with the guys?
Well, when I was 12 or 13, I wanted to start a band, and I just started teaching myself to play guitar. And I made a faith commitment to Jesus at 15, and I just, you know, there's a lot of backstory there, but it was just the natural progression that eventually led to Strongarm. I started a band with two other followers of Jesus in high school, two friends of mine. One guy played bass, one guy played drums. It was absolutely terrible.
Why do you say that?
They left. I wanted to keep going. I met a guy named Dave, and I met Chris Carbonell at church one day, and we kind of struck a conversation up and kind of started a punk rock project. As you heard in Chris's episode, that was called Ichthus, and it was absolutely horrible. And he said, thank God there's no recordings of that. Much to his horror, there actually are some recordings on cassette tapes of that band.
I've had two people email me pictures of their Ichthus tapes.
Yes.
And my buddy Chris, who lives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania with me, I went to his house to hang out one night and have a drink, and he was like, check it out. And he whipped out the Ichthus cassette. I was like, oh boy. I could probably cause some torment for some people.
Yeah, well, no one will ever. I will relieve Chris, and no one will ever hear that because it was terrible. I sang and played guitar in Ichthus. in the beginning, and then eventually when I joined up with Dave and Chris, I let Dave take the vocals and I just played guitar. But then when Strong Arm kind of got put together, when Dave left and we added a bass player, I wasn't really a good songwriter or singer for that matter. I could scream. And so I wanted to concentrate on, I really love writing. I don't get to do it much. And so I concentrated on the lyrics and on the screaming, which became Strong Arm. So Ichthus with Chris, we lost a member or two. I can't, you're asking me to remember like 20, 25 years ago, so I'm going to do my best.
Yes, I am. And, dust off the brain, old man.
Yeah, yes, sir. And there was a local band called Endure, a hardcore band, what I would say old school or traditional 80s style hardcore. Josh was in that band, and that kind of band was floundering. Also, Nick was in that band, and floundering, they were amazing, but they were all high schoolers, so it was kind of like a hobby and not that important. And
okay.
I'm just speaking from my perspective, and I asked Nick and Josh to join. Nick played rhythm guitar, and Josh was a phenomenal songwriter, and I just thought it would be better to have him writing the music than me.
Got it. Okay, I understand. I'm trying to remember how Chris worded his version of it, because he was involved in the same mix at the same time.
Yeah, and we were all friends then. I had met them through Chris, I think. And so Chris and I went to church together and were in the band together. So, and we wanted to get a little heavier. I was, growing up, I was into punk rock and new wave. And if you're if you're old enough to know what that means, so the Smiths, the Sex Pistols, stuff like that. I liked. And it's funny enough, I didn't get into heavy music until I became a Christian, because at the time I was looking for Christian bands, quote unquote, and the best bands at the time were kind of heavy, if you ask me, lyrically and both. Passion, in the sense of passion, and musically, just had the
like
edge.
Who put us in the timeline? Like,
yeah, well, I would say some of my favorite bands at the time, and I would say they held up to secular bands, was the early Crucified music,
sure,
Believer, Scattered Few,
right on,
band called LSU, who was Mike, mm-hmm. headed up by Mike Knott, I guess bands like that. That they had a huge impact on me, and since music was important to me, Strong Arm was the outflow of that. Lyrics and music, I think that's a movie actually, but I always thought those to be very powerful tools for the sake of reaching others for the sake of Jesus.
Okay.
So becoming a Christian, which funny enough got me into heavier music.
Yeah, really. Doesn't sound like that's how it normally goes, but
no. Well, the heavy music was the devil's music back then.
Sure, yeah, this was a whole different tribe that was going on then. Well, when are we talking? Like, put a year on this, ballpark it.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Okay, all right. So how old are you?
I'm 43.
Oh, okay, you're right. Just right around the same.
Yeah. I'm getting achy, but what are you gonna do?
Yeah, like Louis C.K. he says he goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, "Yeah, that just hurts now. That's what that does. There's no fixing that. It just hurts now." I have a couple of those.
That's accurate.
Yep. So then Strong Arm got up to a gallop with. Now you've realigned us. You've aligned us with the lineup that's actually on the first self-titled album. So you guys must have started to practice and write and get up to a stride and start beating up on Florida there, right?
Yeah. So we got together the new lineup and we were practicing in. Chris mentioned my friend and I were going to a Messianic temple. That's Jews for Jesus. I'm not Jewish. But okay. We had some friends from high school that went there, and it was, believe it or not, a really passionate and fun place. And I know this sounds redundant or ridiculous, but Jesus is Jewish. And growing up a white kid in suburbia, it just really brought a lot of life to the Bible, learning it through their perspective. And, you know, you really don't, in this white bread kind of upbringing, you don't see all the double meaning and all the things Jesus is saying. So the head rabbi was a great guy. He gave me a key at 18. He gave me keys and alarm codes to the building and said, anytime nobody's here, you can practice. So we'd go there at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night and practice. Eventually, it's a bit of a long story, but people were saying our music was spreading evil spirits because it was so heavy.
So, it's funny you say that. I was going to ask, did this rabbi know what you guys were doing?
No, he liked it. He just loved the passion in us, and he didn't care about the style of music. And so, but he sat us down and he said, you know, we've had enough people and their elders or their wife is an elder. And it coincided with some of the teenagers' rebellion. So they blamed our music playing in the sanctuary. So, you know, he comes, brings us into his office and says, you know, we've got reports. You know, I just want to sit you down and say, you know, an elder's wife said your music is opening a porthole to hell. And we were like, Rabbi, our music is bad, but it's not that bad, is it? So we moved on to a warehouse, and he felt terrible about it, but it was just it was the right call for him as a leader, and you know, sometimes you just got to put a fire out. So we shared a warehouse with the guys from Shialud. Matt Fox from Shialud.
Sure.
And another local band called Tension. I think that's right. Tension for sure. And it was a couple other bands, Tension for sure, and I think Shialud also was getting started, or shortly after that. Or Matt was in another band or something. I can't really remember.
Okay.
And so we had written four songs and created a demo, which is entitled These Times That Try Men's Souls. And that had four songs on it. And we recorded it. And I got some phone call. I had set up a phone line in my bedroom. It's called a landline. We didn't have cell phones then. We had beepers.
I've heard of this landline. I believe I've seen it in a museum.
Yeah, we had beepers and landlines. So I don't know how it happened, but we had just recorded a demo of four songs we'd written, which was Trials, Count the Cost, Remaining, and Forgiven. It was a phone call from Tooth and Nail Records. And they were doing a compilation album. It was their first compilation. It was called Helpless Amongst Friends.
Right.
So I don't know how they got our number. I don't know anything. We had nothing out there. I think it was really the Lord, because it just makes no sense at all. And I think the rumor is that we played a show with Crash Dog, and they gave them our number, but I don't really know. So that was in Tampa, that show. We were from South Florida. So I called him, said we just recorded a demo, and we sent him our DAT, which is a copy of our master. So they put Count the Cost on that with
DAT, kids. That's using the sorcery of the 80s and 90s. We used to magically have music stick to magnetic tape.
And that was the best quality you could for the budget. I mean, that was
right
good
on.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So Focused was on that. Unashamed was on that compilation. POD. There was a short period of time where Strong Arm was bigger than POD. Fortunately, it didn't hurt their career. So that was a weird thing. So that was our start. After that, we played Cornerstone. That was always a huge thing for Christian bands. Cornerstone. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's like the Christian Woodstock.
Yeah, very.
So we would go every time, and we played the impromptu stage, I think, that year. And Brandon Ebel from Tooth and Nail Records came, and he said, if you put on a good show, I like what I see, I'd be interested in talking to you. So he sat us down, and he was kind of wishy-washy after our show. And I said, listen, we need a decision. We need equipment. We got a lot going on. So he said, okay. And he sent us a check for some equipment, and he came down that November. We re-recorded those four songs and the rest of the album. By that time, we had written eight or nine songs whatever's on our first album, Atonement.
Can I stop you a second? Why do you think he was, to use your words, wishy-washy?
Oh, I don't know if you've ever met Brandon, but he's...
I have not.
He's a good guy. He's just a little bit of a salesman, so I think he was just doing his I'm not sure thing.
Okay.
So I don't know, but you know, when you're in sales meetings, you try to create leverage, I guess. So.
All right. Okay.
So I just said, listen, I think one or two other Christian labels were talking to us, so we just said we'd like to go with you. So what's going to happen?
Who else would have been talking to you around that time? What other labels?
I think Rex Records and I don't know. One of the other ones.
Okay.
Can't remember.
Okay.
Oh, there was a local record label that was talking to us, but we weren't interested in that. But when you're in a sales meeting, you don't tell them that. You just throw it in the mix.
I understand. Okay.
Not that I'm a good salesman. I'm not.
I understand. But you can recognize one. I get it. That's kind of the most important part.
Yeah, so I think at the time I was 20 or 21 or something, and the guys in the band were still, except for Chris, he was my age, and they were still in high school. So I want to say pretty young, 15, 16 at the oldest.
Okay.
Maybe 17. 16, 17 sounds better. I'm not sure. But it seems like when they were in Strong Arm, they were still in high school for a year or two of that time. And that would that would be Josh and Nick and Chad, our bass player.
And Chad, okay. So that sounds about right, because I know Chris said that he's 43, and that's the same age as you. And Chad told me he's 40. So that's about 3 years. So that sounds about right, 16 or 17 in there somewhere. So Brandon cut you guys a check for some equipment.
By the way, what I know now is that just wasn't like free money. That went all onto our debt with Tooth and Nail. That's how that works.
every label. Every label. Nobody, yeah. I don't think anybody's ever handed a band money.
Yeah, they never tell you that. Like when he visited us when we were recording, he took us to dinner. We went to see Interview with a Vampire. You know, we were like, man, this is awesome. Well, we didn't know that was all going on our bill.
You took him to see Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah, we flew him down, gave him a rental, a hotel, and took him out and had a good time on the town.
Got it. Well, live and learn, right?
Yeah.
So after re-recording the four song, then what?
So I want to say the album came, I got it in the mail. And it was, you know, at the time you got CDs and tapes.
Yeah.
And I ran the band. And, you know, I'm not trying to start any fights or anything. I'm just telling you the facts. I'm not here to convince. I'm too old to care about this stuff. I'm just telling you how it went down.
I got you. Yes. And to be clear, I'm not calling you to pit anybody against each other either. So.
You know, I was older than them. So I had the line dedicated to the band. We used my address, my home address. I was still living at home for the band. So I made all the calls, answered all the calls, wrote all the letters. That's what we did. We didn't have email. So we had to use handwriting. I think I had a computer. It was a 186. Does that mean anything to you?
Right on, man. That's the you did the old floppy disks.
I used to write my lyrics in a notebook. So so I can remember getting the Strong Arm CDs and stuff in the mail, maybe March or April or something of that year. And it was just one of the most exciting experiences of my life.
I was going to say that must have felt like the future to have music that you recorded onto a magnetic tape is now magically on this digital spinning record. That must have been crazy.
So I got in the car. I brought the boxes of CDs, and I just drove to the guys and showed them. And it was just mind blowing, very exciting. So we started playing local shows and selling our CDs. It was just very exciting. And you know, the deal we had with Tooth and Nail was terrible. You know, we didn't own anything. They could have picked up a bunch of guys at Home Depot and had them play instruments and call it Strong Arm. But at the time, you're a young band and you just don't have any leverage, and you go with it. It was the only way we could get national exposure at the time. It's not like now, where recording quality on a quality creating a quality recording is you can do it with standard equipment on your Mac that you buy from the store. You couldn't do that then.
Sure.
And within minutes of being done, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but within minutes of being done, I mean, you could have it mastered and uploaded and someone in Uzbekistan could listen to it. You know, we didn't have that option then. The only way to get national exposure was to get on a national label and then tour. That was the only way. So it was very exciting.
How far did that tour get? Like, how big was that tour?
We did several small tours, you know, locally, 5-6 stops up the East Coast. We did a lot of Florida shows, Tampa, Orlando. And then we used a booking agent through Tooth and Nail, and he booked a national tour. And that I think it started after Cornerstone. So we started at Cornerstone and did like 6 weeks after that to support the album. And at the time, it was very successful. I mean, I want to say, you know, when I say successful, I put it in context. You know, I meet bands now and the market is so saturated and there's so much out there. These guys are touring and making $200 or $300 a show and $100 on merchandise. And, you know, you really can't survive like that. Not for long.
And we can't.
We did better than that. I'm not saying we did great, but we did a lot better than that. And it helped us buy our trailer. It helped us replace equipment. It helped, you know, fix flat tires. And it paid for our warehouse and all that kind of stuff. So it was very successful. The money we made on merchandise really sustained us. Especially, honestly, the merchandise money we made at Cornerstone could keep us going for 3 to 6 months. I mean, we still had to work jobs, but I'm just saying,
sure,
it could pay for the band.
And what were you doing in between? I always talk to people about what their non-band life money income is from.
I was going to community college. I stopped for a while once the band started touring more, and I worked construction. My dad remodeled homes, so, you know, I could work with him all the time whenever I was home.
Okay.
I had other odd ends jobs too, but I always came back to that because my dad was flexible like that. You know, it was okay working for my dad. You know how that goes. But I could always be home and go to work, and it was hard work, but and, you know, that was part of my frustration is the guys, their parents were kind of, not Chris, but their parents were kind of still paying their bills. And I was fronting a lot of the money. And if we split up expenses, I had to work for that money. So it was, you know, it was now someone being 3 or 4 years younger than you isn't a big deal. But when you're 21 and 20, It's a different world because they're still in high school or they're just getting out of high school and you're 22.
Sure. I understand.
So that was always kind of an awkward thing, but I you did what you had to do if you believed in your vision.
Right. Gotcha. So speaking of believing in the vision, this is concluding the first album, and then you guys come back and maybe it's time to move on to Advent, and I guess that's when things got, the pieces of ice started to float apart from each other, huh?
Yeah, that happens. You know, I always think of musicians and artists, and I include myself in this, as they kind of act like spoiled brats a lot of the time. I don't know what it is, but when you're creating art, I think you feel like you're like a huge influencer of culture and I don't know, just the current of the world. And so you kind of think you're special and you're really not that special. You're just a person. And, I wanted to keep going and I believed, believe it or not, that you could make a living on this. And I don't mean in the sense to get rich. I just mean I wanted music to be my life.
Okay.
You know, I liked writing and creating. I'm a creative person. And I just felt like the guys that were younger, and this is just my opinion, you know, we were all immature. I was a jerk. It's just part of it. You know, I was 20, 21, 22. I was still a boy myself. And I just felt like I was a little more serious. I was running things, and I was getting frustrated. You know, Nick was the rhythm guitarist, and he was playing two-finger power chords, and I just felt like he needed to step it up a little. And he didn't feel like he did.
Okay.
And he said, we were eating ice cream at a place called Swenson's in South Florida, and he said, listen, if you think I need to go, it's okay. I want to do something else anyway. It's not a big deal to me. And I'm like, really? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Let's see. And at the time, Chris Carbonell was a bit unpredictable, and I wanted to practice, and I felt like we had to hunt him down to find him to practice. Our live shows were not as good as they could be. We had a, this is death to a band, but you know, when you stop in the middle of a song and start over, it's embarrassing, especially when you're trying to talk about what you believe. It just takes away all credibility. And I just felt like we needed to improve in our quality. Not that the music wasn't good, but our performance was just lacking. I mean, we were better than we were, but we weren't where we needed to be. And I had forged a friendship with a guy named Bob at the time, who was in a huge local band called Ambugalard. Amazing musician, a fairly recent follower of Jesus. And I met him at church, and he quit that band. And I'm like, he said, I can play rhythm guitar if you're interested. And we were quickly becoming best friends. And I'm like, well, let me think about that. At the time, we had met a friend of ours, Steve, who ended up becoming in Strong Arm. He played drums in a local band in Tampa. He lived in Tampa called Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a phenomenal drummer. And I don't know how we talked, but I think Pole broke up or something. So I thought, man, if we could get Steve in our band, this would bring the band to the next level. So I did pray about it, and I put serious thought to it, and I had a band meeting, and it did not go well. And I'm not saying I handled it well, but I basically said, and it was kind of a jerky thing to do, and I said, these are the changes I want to make, and if I'm going to continue in this band, this is what needs to happen. And it's not a nice thing. I did spiritualize it, and I'm not sure that the Lord really told me that now, looking back. Sometimes you say that a lot.
Okay.
I wasn't mean about it. I wasn't anything like that. I just said, this is what I want to happen if I'm going to continue. And the guys, they said, well, we'll think about it. And they ended up coming on board with it. And Chris in particular was really hurt by that. And I totally understand that. You know, he should have been hurt by it. It wasn't, you know, didn't go great. It wasn't a nice thing for our friendship. But again, it was just so unpredictable. We had to hunt him down for practices, and it just wasn't going well. And I felt like we needed to regather and get to the next level. And it was an awkward couple months for everybody because we were all kind of friends.
Sure.
And that put a kind of a divide in things. And honestly...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
Can I stop you and ask a question there?
Yeah.
When you kind of threw... Again, not picking fights here, but when you kind of threw an ultimatum down, you kind of threw it in and said, look, here's what I want, or I'm not a part of this anymore. That statement tells me that Strong Arm wasn't yours to have the final say in, because you basically said, this is how I want it, or I will leave you. It wasn't like, this is how I want it, or you're all fired and I'll restaff. So who was like, who was the decision maker at that point? Did I ask that right?
I think so. I'm not sure I heard it right, but if they wanted to quit and start something else, that was fine with me. But I just said, if this is going to be Strong Arm, I was making all the decisions. I was running the band, making all the calls, booking most of the shows, following up, sending CDs out for reviews and interviews and returning phone calls and calling tooth and nail and making sure we had this and making sure we had our shirts and making sure we had enough CDs for the next show. I was doing all that, making sure we practiced, making sure we had band meetings. You know, I was making sure all that happened. So they wouldn't say I was the leader, but I was leading the band, you know, on an administrative sense. I mean, yes, we all shared stuff, you know, hey, maybe one of them would say, you know, let's play a show with them. They talked about it. Absolutely. We all did it together, but in the end, I was doing all the grunt work. So I just felt like if I'm going to continue, this is what needs to happen. And, you know, I wasn't trying to be a jerk. It was a jerky thing, but I just felt like we were just kind of being immature, and I wanted to go to the next level.
Okay.
And okay. I was immature too, so I'm not saying I was exclusively the most awesome guy there, and so that's why they all
listened to me. No, that's fine.
I'm not saying that. I don't know if I answered that.
No, it's okay. I don't think I asked it very well, but I was just curious, like if you would have said, here's what I want or I'm not continuing, and they collectively came back and said, nope, we don't agree to your terms, like at that line in the sand,
we would have broken up.
Who gets quote unquote strong arm? Who
moves on? We would have broken up. I think that.
Oh, I see. I see.
I think the way bands went, and we kind of respect what you did enough. And it wasn't a big deal to start new bands and bands breaking up. I mean, at the time in South Florida, I think there were at any given time 200 or 300 local bands. It's just.
South Florida is still cranking out its own scene constantly. So it seems to be one of those hotbeds.
It wasn't like, you know, and Strong Arm was big. But it wasn't so big, you know. We were just a local band playing shows. So we would have just started a different project, I think. That was the sentiment. It wasn't like Strong Arm was so big that, you know, we'll just do 4 new members and 1 original member and keep going. That wasn't the sense.
Okay. So at that point, you said, here's what I want. And they said, okay, that's fine. What was on that list? Was it this guy Bob?
Yeah, I said, I want to bring Steve and Bob in. Bob will play rhythm guitar. He can play more than 2-finger chords. And Steve's an amazing drummer. And, you know, honestly, it was an awkward couple of months till we were all able to get together. And our first practice was actually in Tampa before Steve could move down. And our first practice, I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything, but was amazingly 4 or 5 times better right away, Strong Arm was.
Wow.
And we all looked at each other, especially with Steve's drumming. We all looked at each other, and nobody really wanted to say it, but the feeling was, you were right. We are better right away.
Okay.
And I think you can see that from Advent and Atonement. You can just see how it's a more robust, fuller, a tighter sound.
Yeah, definitely.
The Strong Arm most people know is this, I guess, the second iteration of it. So,
which is coincidentally short-lived, very short-lived.
Yeah.
Bummer. I didn't get into Strong Arm became one of my favorite bands, and Advent became pretty much my favorite hardcore album after. Like, you guys, you were out by then anyway, but the band had dissolved and moved on by the time I got around to them. And I was like, what do you mean they broke up? I was all pissed about it, but late to the game, Turner. That's me. So
my timeline might be a little bit off when we toured this or that, but those are the basic events. And so with the new lineup, Steve moved down, and we started playing local shows and writing songs.
Right.
And did another tour around Cornerstone. And we recorded a 7-inch for that tour called Trials. And that has the new lineup that I would say is the second iteration. And on the flip side, we recorded – on the flip side. On the B side, we recorded Increase, which appears on Advent. And that's the new lineup.
Right.
And that was a new song that we promoted on tour. We'll be right back.
When was this? When you left Strong Arm and Advent became a thing, this would have been like, I'm guessing 96, 7-ish in there somewhere?
I want to say early 90s, late 95, early 96.
Okay, all right.
I that sounds right. I think it's got to be early 96.
Okay.
I can't really remember. It seems like they went on about 2 years after me, which I think is right. I think they broke up in 98. And when I quit, I wrote some music for a little while there, but basically I just stepped out of heavy music altogether. It was so devastating for me. I just started listening to jazz and classical and top 40 and new wave again from the 80s. I just stepped out of heavy music altogether. I would go to a local show from time to time just to see friends, but I basically, in respect to them and just to make a clean break, I basically just stepped out of the scene altogether and quit heavy music altogether and didn't really start listening to it again till about 4 or 5 years after that.
Okay, so musically, you were kind of laying low, going to the scene once in a while just to be like, hey, I'm not dead.
Yeah.
But you kind of were out of it, and then out of the blue, somewhere around 2000, you get a phone call, right?
From, what are you talking about?
Talking about the reunion show.
Oh, the one that created some controversy?
Yes, that one.
That's 09. That's 09. That's not that early.
For crying out loud, what am I thinking of then?
I don't know what you're... If you're thinking of Furnace Fest and that, I never got a call on any of that. When they did their reunion in 2000. I got emails and stuff. I did an interview in 99 or 2000 for a Strong Arm tribute site, and it made him mad, but I figured it had been several years, and I can tell part of my story, and... So I said one or two things in there that made them mad, which, you know, I didn't say anything huge. I just said, you know, I quit Strong Arm because I felt like we weren't where we should be spiritually and as people. I don't find that very controversial, but it infuriated them, a couple of them. You know, hey, I'm allowed to tell my story too. So,
sure.
So it wasn't a big deal. What I did after that is I went to Bible college. The guy that quit, Bob, he went to Bible college, so I decided to go to Bible college too. I hated college, but I figured I better study something I like. So I did that, and he went to start a church in Miami, so I went with him to support him in that, and I spent about 5 years doing that. So that's what happened. I spent a couple years. I was a paint contractor. I went to Bible college. I met a girl, married her, went down to Miami, helped start a church with Bob, eventually went on staff there. So that's what was going on in the early 2000s.
Okay, all right. I got my timeline messed up then. So your book and the controversial reunion show came out right around the same time.
Yeah, so
okay.
I spent 5 years at that church, and this will get back to Strong Arm. We were living in South Florida, and I just started to get really burned out. The church had grown from like six people to a few hundred people. And when you're working in, I think everybody who follows Jesus is in ministry, I'm a handyman now, whether you're a handyman or a preacher, everybody's in ministry. I don't like when people say, you know, hey, I work in full-time ministry. I find that kind of insulting to people. I hate to say it, but regular folks.
Right.
I just started to get burnt out. I love Bob. He was my best friend, but working for him was really mentally challenging and stressful. It just was really a bad place mentally. So my wife and I had a couple kids. We got sick of South Florida and the heat and the zero lot lines. I don't know if you know what that means. You have no yard. So
okay. No, I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah, all the houses in South Florida have zero lot lines. Lot, you know, the property.
Right.
And so we talked about moving. We ended up deciding on moving to Atlanta, and we've been here about 11 years.
Okay.
So
is that really much cooler Yes. South Florida?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Is it really? Okay.
It's a whole different world. We love Georgia. In Florida, if you want to do something different, you got to drive 10 hours. Here, we can drive a half an hour, 45 minutes, and do like 10 different things.
Okay, I see.
You know, in South Florida, you can. I know this sounds weird, but all you really can do is you're kind of housebound 11 months of the year because it's so hot. You don't really want to go outside and take 3 showers a day. So you can go to the mall and you can go to the beach and stuff like that. And
okay.
It gets boring. And I lived there my whole life, and we just wanted a change. And I wanted to write again. We went to a conference in Atlanta, and I just felt like I wanted to write. And at the church, I just didn't have time for that. It was still it had grown to 300 or 400 people, but I was wearing 5 or 6 different hats.
Mm-hmm.
I was on staff now, and it was just, I'm not an office guy, and this was an office life, and I just couldn't do it. So the short story is we sold our house and moved to Atlanta, and I started writing a book. I'd never written a book, but I've written. And so I spent a couple years working part-time and writing my first book, which is called 10 Things I Hate About Christianity. And it's a book about working. it's angst like hardcore, and it's a book about working through the frustrations of faith.
I got you, and it's definitely a title that it's designed to grab people's attention.
Yeah, and that's just why I liked hardcore. It's just that same kind of passionate expression of what you're feeling viscerally deep down inside.
Right.
So I go through kind of the things that I did in the lyrics of Strong Arm, and that is just all the foundational things in my faith that I'm always constantly having to work through, like, faith itself, living in the unknown, prayer, rules and sin, the Bible, church, other Christians, answers to difficult questions. So I wrote that book. So this is when the recession hit. You remember that?
Very well.
So I sent my manuscript out to, a bunch of publishers, and it was a time when new talent with no name and no investment, with no platform, wasn't an investment publishers wanted to make. So
okay.
I got a lot of offers of kind of hybrid. They would sort of self-publish. They would do this, and I would need to do that. And after researching it, since I was essentially a nobody with no platform, I just said, you know what? I'm just going to do this on my own. So I incorporated, hired an editor and an artist, and did print-on-demand publishing. Found a company that distributes through a distributor called Ingram, and it's totally legit, and it prints it on demand, and you can order it anywhere in the world where books are sold. So that's the route I went.
Got it.
Okay, so 09, back to Strong Arm. By the way, I haven't written another book. I want to one day, but life doesn't afford me that right now. And maybe that's another story in a few more minutes as we recap it. But
okay.
In February of 09, I got a call from maybe January, February, a guy named Joshua Stump, and he ran a stage at Cornerstone called the Anchor Stage.
Okay.
And he asked if I'd be... I had contact with him from time to time. Not a lot. I had periodic contact with people through Strong Arm over the years. Like in 08, I had spoken at a conference called Unified Underground, put on by Youth for Christ. And the guy who did that, it was called Loyal Thurman, and he's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
Huge Strong Arm fan. Atonement is his favorite album. Yada, yada, yada. Formative experience in his conversion and continuing to follow Jesus. So through that, I met Joshua Stump. He called me, asked me if I'd like to do a reunion show. And I said, I'm open to it, but those guys aren't going to want to do it. I've been asked this before. They don't want to have anything to do with me. I don't know why, but I'll ask them. So I call information, and I get Chris Carbonell's home phone number, and I left him a message, never heard back from him. called him a second time, left a message with his wife, who was very nice, but I never heard from him. So I found Chad on Facebook and sent him a message. Never heard from him, then bothered him again. And he said, "Now we're not interested. If you want to do something, you know, go ahead, but you can't call it a strong arm reunion." So okay. I was like, fine. So I tell Joshua, by this time, it's like, I didn't hear from them for a month or two. So by this time, it's like March, April. He needs an answer because he needs a band to start practicing. So he says, well, why don't we call it a tribute show? And I said, hey, that's a good idea. And you sing it, and we'll just do the old songs. Well, I said, fine. I got a book coming out. I'll come to Cornerstone, bring my book, and do the tribute show. It seemed like a great thing. I'll bring my kids. I had three kids at the time and wife, and we'll make it a family trip, summer trip. I hadn't been to Cornerstone. Music was huge in my life. I want this for them, too, my children. So I told Chad, he said, sure, sounds good. Then in a couple weeks, I get an email from Josh. Hey, we don't want you doing this. You know, you're just doing it to sell books and this and that. And, I said, respectfully, I'm doing it. I'm going anyway. And so what if I have a book coming out? You know, I'm an adult here. I was 35, 36, 37. I'm going to do it. And you guys used Strong Arm to promote Further Seems Forever. I don't really see what the problem is here. Mm-hmm. So I got another email from Steve telling me I wasn't allowed to do it. And I respectfully told him the same thing. I wasn't rude or anything, but I'm an adult. I run my own life. And I never realized they had a visceral hatred towards me. You know, we were all jerks back then. I didn't really know that everything was my fault. At least that was my impression after all of this. But, you know, I was a jerk too. So I'm not trying to make myself look better. But they actually...
I understand.
They bought the domain. This is where it gets weird. They bought the domain strongarmreunion.com. And they posted a page and just said all these things about me and delegitimized me. And I've never heard of a secular band doing that, much less a Christian band. So that put the kibosh on the reunion, our tribute show, because Joshua said, hey, you know, this is just too much bad PR for my stage. So we still went. I still talked and met a bunch of great people. My kids and I had a great time. We rented an RV, and it was still one of the best experiences of my life. And I hope a formative experience for them. And I still brought my book, and I set up a booth and sold books. And I sold, you know, didn't sell enough to pay for the trip, but I sold more than a lot of the bands there, and that was pretty cool. And it was a good time. It was a really good time.
Okay, all right. What sort of stuff was put on the website that you said? I think you used the word discredited you or something. I did not catch.
Yeah, just the same thing that I'm just doing it to sell books, and they didn't want me tarnishing the memory of Strong Arm and this and that. I don't really know what that means, but as far as we were always concerned is that Strong Arm always belonged to all of us, and once the band broke up, I didn't really see the problem with it. I never did this when the band was together. I really didn't care. I mean, I respect people contacting me about it, but I wasn't looking to relive my dreams in Strong Arm or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know,
I see.
I was just going to support people who it meant something to them and take my kids on a trip.
Okay. All right. I understand.
So you got a little bit more dirt there. My wife said you shouldn't say all that, but I said, hey, I'm going to tell the facts.
Well...
and I wish them all. I wish the guys the best. I always did. I always celebrated Further Seems Forever's success. I think that band is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean that is one of the best unknown bands ever, if you ask me. And I always celebrated their success to friends and stuff. So I really didn't understand the twist it took. I really didn't.
That was 2009. It's 2016. Has there been any mending of any of this? Or
no, I wish the guys the best, but after that, what I would call sucker punch, I really don't want to have anything to do with them. I wish them the best. I hope they're doing well, and I hope they make music again and it's successful. But that was really dirty. I just couldn't believe that they posted a website. That was kind of where it went to the next level for me.
I see. Okay. Again, late to the game. I didn't know any of this was going on until it was all said and done.
Yeah, but, and most people don't. And honestly, I feel like that tarnished the legacy of Strong Arm more than anything. Me mm-hmm. selling my book that nobody bought is not a big deal. You know? I just didn't understand it.
Tell me a little bit more about that book. I'm actually a little curious what's in there. I don't think I'd mind reading something like that.
Yeah, it's an honest, passionate description of my faith, which I am still a follower of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
I've noticed that you've thrown the term follower of Jesus around much, much more, like 90-10 with calling yourself Christian. I'm curious if you
yes,
see
I'm a way. Christian. I just feel like follower of Jesus is more descriptive.
I see. Okay. All right.
Sometimes the word Christian is baggage, and you know, a lot of people call themselves Christians, and they are. I am a Christian, but the original term for followers of Jesus was followers of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Christian is a term that was given to followers of Jesus, kind of as a joke. And because they were so different at the time, they associated themselves with the poor and the sick and people with leprosy, people who were untouchable. So it was as if they were from another place. So you had Ephesians and Romans, and they kind of made a joke. And these Christians, they're from another place. They don't make sense.
Mm.
So the original term was followers of the way, which appears in the book of Acts. That's what Christians called themselves, but Paul adopted the term Christian because, you know, it made sense. But it's not an action term. It's it's just a descriptive word. Followers of the way is an action statement, so if I say follower of Jesus, which I am a Christian, I'm just
okay.
saying.
I'm just wondering.
Yes, sir. I'm not some part of some weird sect that doesn't want to use the word Christian.
Those are out there. That's why I'm asking. Those exist. Those exist.
So,
okay,
all right,
cool. So, what's the future hold? Do you own your own handyman business?
Yeah, I always come back to home improvements. I had hoped that the book would sell enough to sustain the next project. It did not.
Okay.
We lost a ton of our money and stuff on the recession, and I just had to go back to home improvements. And you know, being in my 40s now, I believe my responsibility is to help my children discover their hopes and dreams. I'm not in a place where I can come home from work and go into the bedroom and write and work on my hobbies and dreams. I can't do it on Saturday. You know, my dad worked all the time. He never did anything and spent time with me. I'm not going to have that legacy. I love my dad. He's a good guy, but I'm just saying, I spend my evenings hanging out with my kids, eating dinner, cleaning up, or watching a TV show in my week, or in my weekends going to their baseball games, or taking them to the field to work on their technique and getting some reps in. Or
I got you.
We've done that and gone to two movies this weekend, so it's been a 4-day weekend. So I feel my responsibilities as now is helping my kids discover their hopes and dreams, unless the Lord presents a huge opportunity for me or something where I could change the direction of my life, but I just can't do that now. So, and I don't say that as with a sense of sadness. I just say that that's
I get it.
Adult responsibility, and maybe one day it'll circle back around, but that's not where we are now.
Big boy pants, right? Yeah.
Yes. The millennials listening, if there are any, hopefully we'll understand that one day.
I think I have a blend of millennials in the
crowd. And that's no insult, but you know, I was young once too, and you know, in your 20s and 30s you can do your dreams, and but there comes a point where you got to be responsible.
Yeah, but our pants weren't that tight. I will point that out.
Yes, they were. They were called women's pants, and that's where that's where you bought
them. All right. Careful. Careful now.
Yeah, the thing about skinny jeans is they go on, one, skinny people, two, women.
Dude, I'm not. I'm not going there
with you. You want to go there, you know it's true. It's all right.
I'm not cut. Like you said, to your first point, they have to go on skinny people. I'm not cut for skinny jeans, so I don't have to go to point number two.
I'm
gonna be super political about that.
I don't know if you've noticed, but people they're not worried about being cut for skinny jeans. They still wear them.
Oh, I've noticed. I understand.
Anyway.
Tangent. Hey, man, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I'm glad you took the time, man. I appreciate it, Jason.
I appreciate it. Maybe you heard a little bit more than you wanted to, but that's the story.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.